And now, does this sound familiar to you? The room is hot, the chair you're sitting in is uncomfortable, all you have to stare at is the blackboard in front of you, grey walls around you, and through the window, an empty quadrangle. Everyone else has gone home, but you're stuck in detention. It turns out this kind of punishment is still the main approach used in Australian schools today for bad behaviour. Children as young as five are being removed from classrooms around the country every day. And it's a punishment that can then escalate from detention to suspension to getting expelled. But do these methods actually do what they're supposed to do? Well, we'll hear some answers soon, but I'd also be interested to hear about your experience as a child or with the children in your life when it comes to detentions, being suspended or expelled. Did it work? If not, what did? You can text on 0418 226 576 or contribute to the Life Matters Facebook page. Dr. Anna Sullivan is Associate Professor at the University of South Australia's School of Education. School discipline is one of her research areas. Anna, thank you for joining us.
Oh, that's a pleasure.
Now, we probably all remember the naughty kids being punished in school or being punished if you were the naughty kid. What's the rationale for detention, suspension, expulsion and its history?
Yes, I think it is. For a very long time, those sorts of punitive approaches, is what we call them, have been used because they've been seen to be a way of letting kids know that it's not okay. And it was thought that they would learn that there were better ways of doing things or whatever and change their behaviour. It sort of comes out of the field of psychology, I think. You know, you reward good behaviour and you give a negative consequence to bad behaviour. So you're sort of trying to influence and control behaviour by the actions that respond to particular actions. You know, the children's actions.
But what does your research, the research, say about this approach?
Yeah, well, we've been doing research for a number of years and brought together other researchers to work out what's going on. And what we know is, you know, the days of corporal punishment are nearly gone in Australia. There are still some places that use it. But there's sort of the dominant way of doing things in school still relies on sort of two main approaches. One is it's all about influencing behaviour. So one is sort of a very public approach. So in classrooms or in an assembly or something, it might be drawing attention to the bad behaviour or the child with the bad behaviour, making it very public as a sort of message to everyone else that actually you can't do this. Another thing that happens is sort of starting to remove them, usually in step type consequences, so they get more severe. So it might be you give them a warning or you go and sit over there or you're in time out or you go to the principal's office or you get a detention or suspension or whatever. So it's all about removing them from their learning or their learning environment. And
what are the consequences that you're seeing of that?
Yeah, well, it's pretty clear now from international research as well that this exacerbates the problem. So kids start to feel very alienated from school. They don't feel connected to the teachers or their peers, or they get embarrassed, or they feel uncomfortable seeing their peers being treated like that. And so it really doesn't support kids being at school, feeling welcome there and a good learning environment. And then kids who are continually removed from their learning, they obviously don't know what's going on, and then they come back and they don't know what to do, and so it sort of exacerbates their problem. And often those kids are the ones that have got learning problems to begin with, and so they probably need more support rather than pulling them out from their learning.
Well, let's hear now from Chris Cox. He's the founder of the advocacy group Protecting Childhood. Now, Chris, your son, who's now 12, when he was going to the local school in the suburbs of Brisbane, started behaving in ways that were worrying for you. Tell us about this.
Thanks, Amanda. Yeah, we started experiencing it pretty much from prep, but it sort of escalated from around about year three, where he'd come home from school and would explode, basically, in fits of rage. It was just pent-up anger which would, you know, he'd unleash on his mother and his siblings. And it was a nearly a daily occurrence, and we were nearly at our wit's end with it. What was really interesting about it was that when we spoke to teachers about it, they were surprised because he was a perfectly well-behaved child at school.
Oh, so he wasn't naughty at school?
Not at all, no. He they spoke of glowing terms, that he was a wonderful member of the class. He was quiet. He did his work and behaved. So
what was going on?
We really struggled to work out what that was. So the first thing we did was we blamed ourselves as parents. We must be doing something wrong. So we looked into our parenting techniques, looked into things like positive parenting, which interestingly advocates some of the same kind of punitive measures that Anna was talking about with timeouts and things like that. We also looked at diet. We took out a lot of additives and preservatives, which we know can influence irrational behaviour. And even sought the advice of a child psychologist. All these approaches, they sort of helped him deal with some of the symptoms, but it didn't really solve the problem. These anger issues were still coming out. What we sort of came to realise when we started looking into the respectful parenting style of parenting, which talks more about understanding that behaviour is a result of an unmet need, and that it's a reaction rather than a thing that can actually be fixed directly. And what research was leading to was that a lot of this was coming from the school environment, where they didn't have the freedom to do what they physically needed to do. And particularly my son, being very physically active, he really wanted to be able to run around and play sport and really get in and be physical, and being confined to a desk all day, that was we think that was one of the main things that was leading to his frustration.
Was there also anything to do with, you know, seeing other kids getting detention and being concerned that that was going to happen to him?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly in the earlier years, what we found was things like a smiley and frowny face board, where people's names would move between them based on their behaviour, and the shame that sort of came from that, saying, oh, they were on the naughty face today. And I think there was a real fear about that. He really didn't want to draw attention to himself. He just wanted to just drift along and not be noticed. So I think those kind of things contributed to it greatly.
Well, Chris, I'm gonna pause your story there. I'll come back to you to find out what you did from there to help with your son's rage that he was expressing at home. But let's hear now from Peter Hutton. Peter is the principal at Templestowe College, which is in northeastern Melbourne. Now, Peter, before we talk specifically about your school, does what Chris is saying about his son sound familiar to you?
Well, it certainly does from a personal perspective, Amanda, because I probably would have been on that unhappy face side of the board most of my school time.
As a kid?
Absolutely.
You were a naughty kid?
Look, I am a person who has dyslexia, and so I found the demands of school, particularly more so primary actually than secondary, meant that I was often on the unhappy side of the board.
Well, tell us about what's particular about Templestowe College.
I guess there's a lot of things that are different to the traditional model of education.
First of all, it's a state school, yeah?
It is a state school, and we're incredibly proud of that fact, because, you know, a lot of people think that this should be in an independent school, but I can't see why a parent needs to have $20,000 to $30,000 of idle cash each year to pay for quality education. And we have some great state schools, and I'm really pleased that an alternative type school is a government school.
So what's alternative about your school?
I guess I'd also have to just be cautious in, and I know I used the term alternative. All it is good educational practice, and that is, rather than serving up students, you know, a one size fits all program, we go the complete opposite way. We start from what's a child's individual needs, both learning, social, all aspects. Where do they want to go? What would they like to do? And then build a program from that. So rather than, you know, almost every other school that I'm aware of has year levels. we have no year levels. So students start with us in an entry program where we're able to just monitor them a little bit more closely, give them some extra support as they transition into the school. But then they might stay with us for 6 years, most of them will, but some of them may well graduate after 4 years and go to university. So we've had our first 16-year-old go to university this year. You know, so students can...
And others of them stay longer?
Absolutely. So we can have students graduate in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, but some might just really benefit from one additional year, a seventh year, even perhaps an eighth year.
So if I went to your school, would I get a detention?
Well, you couldn't because we don't have them, so mm-hmm. it's impossible to actually
so
give
what
one.
Do you do? What happens when there are behavioural issues?
Well, I guess just before we move on to there, it's not just about removing year levels. We have no compulsory subjects once students have got established literacy and numeracy skills. So once they're, you know, functionally literate and numerate, they're actually able to select 100% of what they study from more than 150 electives. And what our experience has been is when students are able to learn things that are relevant to them, that they consider are important because they've chosen them, and the materials presented at the right level, so they're neither really struggling or bored because they've already learnt it, about 80% of all disciplinary problems just disappear. They actually vanish. So it's not like we're Nirvana. We have students with a normal range of behavioural issues and mental health issues, all of those sorts of things, but we don't have detentions. What we do have is conversations. We do have a timeout policy, I might say. So any student that disrupts the learning environment for 2 minutes is asked to leave the room. And that's not done in an aggressive way. We have a no yelling policy at the school. And that actually applies more so, to be honest, to the staff than the students. So our definition is that the staff members have to speak to the students the same way they would as if their parent were sitting beside them. So that's a pretty high bar, and it's the student's definition of whether they've been yelled at that we take into account. So a staff member might not have raised their voice unduly loudly, but students know when they've been disrespected. But I've got to say, we've got an amazing group of staff, and it's not really an issue for us at the school.
Now, some people might be listening to this, Peter, thinking it sounds a little bit hippy-dippy, but you're actually no stranger to discipline and punishment yourself, as well as being a principal or assistant principal for a number of years in regular schools. You were an officer in the Army Reserve, yeah?
Yeah.
So when did you start thinking traditional punishment methods don't work?
Well, believe it or not, the Army's not quite as just punishment focused as people are led to believe, and they work a lot off relationships and empowering soldiers to make good decisions. And part of where we got the idea for the model that we have at Templestowe was from actually running an Army cadet unit, where I saw young people, the ages of 15, 16, looking after other groups of students for 7 days at a time, and in many cases managing those situations better than most adults. And so it led me to ask the question, what would happen if we didn't run schools on a dictatorial teacher directing all operations, and we actually empowered students to lead other students. So we've done that at TC. We have students on our leadership group, the main decision body making at the school. We have them on college council. We have them on curriculum committee. We actually won't make decisions without not consulting, but actually involving and including students in that decision making process.
How interesting that came from an Army cadet experience. This is Life Matters with Amanda Smith, continuing the back-to-school focus with a discussion about discipline and punishment for bad behaviour. And do tell us about punishment at school for the children in your life. What has or hasn't worked as far as you're concerned? You can text on 0418 226 576 or post to the Life Matters Facebook page. Now, Anna Sullivan, in your research at the University of South Australia, you've looked at alternative models, schools like Templestowe College that take a different approach to the old punitive measures. Does the research bear out what Peter is saying and seeing?
Yes, because what Peter's describing is a focus on what we call an educative approach. So you see all aspects of the child and their learning, which includes their behaviour, as an education type issue, that they need to learn the skills. Like if there's a conflict, that, you know, a conversation to help resolve that conflict's important or solve the problem. So the schools that we did research in probably don't call themselves alternative, and they may not be offering an alternative curriculum in the way they that Peter is. But what they do is place a focus on, like what Peter was talking about, the relationships, making sure students feel cared for rather than just cared about. And there's quite a bit of research from the students to say that that's very important, making sure that they have a very engaging curriculum, that teachers treat children with respect and in ways that take them seriously, so that issues aren't, you know, that could be perceived as a behaviour issue, aren't just dealt with a punitive action and say, right, we've dealt with that, when, like what Chris was saying, there's probably underlying causes. The other thing they're really committed to is treating children, all children, with respect and dignity. So those public forms of punishment, like the smiley face and the unhappy face, which is so prominent in our primary schools, aren't used. They will not humiliate children in that way or use threats and intimidation to try and coerce kids to behave. It's more about educating them about why we need to treat people with respect and giving them the skills to be able to do that.
I'm wondering, though, if all the research is saying that, you know, the old ways of punishing kids don't work, why we're continuing with them, you know, in many, many schools.
Oh, well, I mean, it's a really good question. When I went through Teachers College, that we didn't actually learn a lot. It was around understanding behaviour and how to build collaborative communities, how to be assertive, how to resolve conflict. All of those sorts of skills were sort of assumed that we would learn on the job. When we know that there is big bodies of research and practice there that can inform us. But the other thing that is it's sort of a new body of research, if you like. I think there have been people doing research around the world, but it's only recently, say, that the first handbook for classroom management, for example, that came out, and that was only, you know, within the last decade. So it's only recently that researchers are getting together and actually communicating their research under the umbrella of discipline, I suppose, whereas it used to be under the curriculum areas or other things. So there's a whole lot of reasons. And the other thing is the policies and the practices. So in all our legislations in the different states and territories in the Education Act, there's always something around what the department or principals can do in terms of suspending and excluding kids. So they'll have policies on that, but then they'll also have policies in the departments or Catholic Ed or wherever around health and well-being of children. So they're often conflicting, and I don't think we've resolved that yet terribly well across the country in ensuring our policies actually complement each other, which guide the practices then that happen in schools. Because we know that the work that teachers do and principals do. They're all well intended and doing the best they can under often very, very difficult circumstances. So to have sort of a big change, we need to have that sort of policy direction from the top, I think.
Well, it sounds like, Anna, there's some happy children, laughing children behind you. Let's come back to Chris Cox. Chris, let's talk about how you dealt with the problem of your son developing behavioural problems at home, not because he was actually naughty at school, but because he was reacting to the sort of, as you say, punitive environment of the school. How did you get to the root of the problem, and what did you do about it?
Well, I have to give most of the credit to my wife, Amy, on that. She was obviously the one that was bearing the brunt of it, so she was spending the time trying to understand. And it came down to more and more research into what she was doing about schools like Templestowe and those other environments where it was about the kids' well-being as a whole. And that led her down the path of homeschooling, which I was very sceptical about to begin with.
But, why?
Well, I was concerned about the amount of pressure it would put on her, to be perfectly honest, plus the usual fears that a parent has is like, we're not teachers. How do we know that we're doing the right thing? How do we know we're not breaking their education? Which we're conditioned to believe, obviously, but we Amy was very, very good at convincing me that, well, as parents, we are their primary educator. That is our main role in life. So we took the plunge of homeschooling. It was nearly 2 years ago now. We did that for, well, we planned to do it long term, but it only ended up lasting about 6 months, only because we found a community school in our local area, well, not too far away from our local area, which very much sounds like similar philosophies to Templestowe College. We got a 2 week free enrollment. Unfortunately, with that school, it's an independent one, so it's not a state school. So there was some financial investment involved in being able to do that, but we wanted to try it, and the kids just thrived immediately.
Yes, well, tell me what difference it made to your son and that sort of terrible anger that he was bringing home with him from school.
Yeah, well, the anger evaporated. It was almost completely gone. The usual brotherly squabbles that you would have, but it wasn't the outright rage that there was before. A lot of that is down to the environment of the school. Similar to what Peter was saying with Templestowe, is that conflict is dealt with almost democratically. It's designed to, the kids are taught how to talk through their problem and sort it out that way. To the point even where my son, who was in the senior years of that primary school, if they have an issue with a rule, they actually have the opportunity to question that with a teacher, respectfully, of course, but to actually say, hang on, I don't think this rule really works for me, or that decision that you made, I feel like that's punishing me unfairly because... And they're allowed to have these respectful discussions rather than that's the rule, decision made, deal with it. So he felt respected. And what we saw as the biggest outcome of that, which was most exciting for us, was that he was engaging in learning again. There were things he wanted to learn again, whereas in the state system, he was increasingly resisting anything. He wouldn't read. He was getting to the point where he would just do the absolute bare minimum just so he wouldn't get in trouble, but he wasn't actually engaging in taking in what they were learning or finding any joy in it.
Mm. Now, Peter Hutton, just coming back to you, so there's that independent community school in Brisbane, there's Templestowe College in Melbourne that you're running. That all sounds great, but for teachers and parents listening, they might be saying, what can I do?
Look, I think Chris summed it up, you know, very well by saying that parents are the primary educator, and I think in some ways, the traditional school system tries to keep parents at a distance and doesn't allow them significant input. And that's why, you know, homeschooling can work, particularly as a circuit breaker. But, you know, fortunately...
But not everyone can do that.
No, but... And that's true. And a number of families don't have the financial or even educational background to enable them to do that. But what parents can do is start lobbying and joining together and raising their concerns with their local state schools. And, you know, I'm delighted that the TC model is spreading. We have visitors through the school all the time. Mount Alexander College and Bundoora Secondary College have now taken on very similar programs.
Right, so it is starting to spread a bit. Peter Hutton is the principal at Templestowe College in northeastern Melbourne, a school that's organised in a quite different way to most to manage student behaviour. Anna Sullivan is associate professor at the University of South Australia's School of Education. And Chris Cox is a parent in Brisbane and the founder of the advocacy group Protecting Childhood. Thank you to you all for your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Life Matters. I'm Amanda Smith.